1, 2, 3, 4.
Where arts and culture summits the airwaves, this is the Nine Rails Arts Podcast. I am R. Brandon Long, alongside Todd Opendorfer, and we are the Banyan Collective, arts and adventure podcasting since 2010. This episode includes an interview with James Argo of Industrial Art and Design, along with Jake McIntyre of Union Creative Agency. We spoke with James and Jake in what they refer to as the Fishbowl Room on the second level of the newly renovated Argo House. The Argo House is described as a design colony located on 25th Street in the heart of Ogden's Nine Rails Creative District. Tenants of the Argo House are varied in expertise and pursuits united through their passion for creativity. Philadelphia-based Ballet X, a premier contemporary ballet company featuring world-class dancers, toured through Ogden thanks to the Ogden Symphony Ballet Association. And we were able to chat with Associate Artistic Director Tara Keating, along with dancer Richard Villaverde.
I'll tell you what, I do feel honored to be as, you know, sort of central to the creation of this Nine Rails Creative District as I have, because I've had the opportunity, you know, along with many others, to see the development of these different creations, including the Argo House. I remember months ago, was it a year ago? One of my first tours of the space, and I'll tell you what, there were no walls, there's no staircases. We're going to talk about that a little bit in the interview. But from then to now, in such an incredible short period of time, this Argo House and what they've done is probably one of the first, you know, creative spaces in the new district.
Yeah, and it's gorgeous, and we get a history of sort of how bad it was when they took over the Argo House.
This was not an easy project for them.
Yeah, not at all. So this is our interview with James Argo and Jake McIntyre.
So welcome to Argo House. We are sitting down with James Argo and also Jake McIntyre. And what do you call in this room?
Think tank.
In the think tank.
Or the fishbowl, depending on how you want to.
It's definitely one of the rooms you can see from the street off of 25th. What's your address specifically?
529 25th Street.
So it's on the corner of Porter and 25th. You can't miss it. I think we should really talk about the house first.
Yeah, sure.
So what brought you to the neighborhood? How long ago was it? Did it turn out the way you wanted it to?
Yeah. This has been a fun project. We've been working on it about 2.5 years already. And originally it started, I guess, just in a conversation I kind of had with Jake and him inviting me to a...
Were you drinking? Were the drinks?
No, yeah. We were okay, actually working, okay, which gotcha. Is kind of a rare thing. But... yeah, we had this conversation. He's like, hey, we're doing this brainstorming session about trying to come up with a name for this arts district proposal we're working for the city. And I was like, yeah, I'm great. I love doing stuff like that. So I went and participated with that. And that kind of got me thinking. I was I had my little two-person business at Startup Ogden downtown. And after...
And what were you doing over there?
Industrial design.
Same thing.
Yeah, yeah. So I run a little industrial design business, and we do a lot of CAD work and modeling and stuff like that. But anyway, that's when I first learned about the aspirations of the community to sort of start an arts district. And I wanted to move out of Startup Ogden into my own studio space. And so I had been looking for places. And
really, that's the dream of artists.
Yeah.
Is to do, I mean, you have such a success story. And then, you know, to the 10th, like you nailed it.
Well, thanks. But it's one of those things where it's just slow. You just have to hang in there and just keep pushing, plugging along. But so we actually found this building on Google Maps. We were looking for a studio space. We had just got some new tools. And so we needed a shop. And we found this building. It was abandoned and it was for sale. So I contacted the seller, who was basically a house flipper. He just bought it. He's from out of Salt Lake or Park City somewhere.
Now, how long did he own the house?
I think he had it for maybe a year or two.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So
he's one of those slower flippers.
Yeah.
But he wasn't doing anything with it.
Yeah. That was the sort of the problem is that no one could figure out what to do with it. You know, because we're in the this is the last house going east in the central business district. So it's a commercial building. And what do you do in an old house that has, you know, 11 bedrooms? You know, this is about 10,000 square feet. So it's kind of a...
And for anybody who hasn't, you know, seen it before and after, it looks beautiful, but it looks very different than it
did. Yeah. It was pretty rough.
It was pretty rough.
So it's been a lot of different things over its life, including a residence for an Ogden mayor. It's been two different funeral homes. It's been,
let's talk about that for a second. What remnants do you have of that?
James has a good one from the shop. Yeah.
So, in the basement, there is, some strange, slanted concrete flooring and drains that I believe was the embalming room. So that's kind of creepy. the shop space that where we have our industrial design model shop was actually the garage for the hearses. So it's the hearse garage.
I love that.
Yeah, there's a nice car wash drain in there. I guess they would detail out the hearses and, you know.
You got to keep it looking fine.
Yeah, so so that's good.
Did you find coffin boxes? Or
Yeah, so when we first got this place, we were just renting the garage.
Backspace, right?
Yeah, we just rented that.
The hearse
right?
garage.
And yeah, the hearse garage. And it had been, this building's last occupants were the sober living home. And I guess, you know, 20 or 30 transitioning sober guys were living here. And
that was some time, wasn't it, Jake?
Yeah, I think it was a sober living house for 40 years.
Yeah, for That's a while, quite some yeah. time. Okay. And I don't know why they stopped. Maybe the funding ran out or whatever.
Ogden just ran out of people.
Drugs.
That's clearly the case.
Yeah, that's clearly the reason.
Listen, it's a nice observation. Story is what I'm saying. Yeah.
Yeah. So the garage had been used for a dumpster, and it had a huge, probably like 40-foot long, 10-foot high pile of garbage that included rotten couches and dirty laundry and even a petrified cat and other stuff like that.
Do you like hazmat suited? You taking these things to the trash?
So I can be somewhat frugal, so I recognized that as an opportunity, and I was able to rent the garage for $50 a month because it was full of garbage. Right. And then the house was abandoned and squatters were living here. So the property owner basically said, yeah, $50 a month and just watch out for the house and make sure no one starts a fire in there or something like that. Mm. So I basically cleaned. Yeah. It was kind of exciting.
Did you have squatters when you started?
Yeah. I came
in. Like you shared the space with them or did you give them the.
Well, sharing is not really the right word.
Well, you were paying. They were paying less.
Yeah, so
they were around though.
Do you play your music real loud?
No, I politely asked them to leave. You know, it's not an easy situation having to squat or live somewhere. You know, and so it was a big bad situation because there was no water on here. Mm. There was no electricity, and so there were things going on in here that were, let's just say, unsanitary. So it took about a month of me showing up every morning and like, you know, shooing people off the porch who were sleeping, and came in a couple times and people were, you know, stealing metals,
right,
copper pipes and stuff out of the house. Mm. And I confronted them in a polite way. And
I wouldn't, looking at this building now, walking through it, I would never, ever think that happened here. That's
two
how clean
ago.
It. Yeah, that's how clean it is and beautiful and updated. I mean, it is gorgeous.
Thank you. It's been a huge renovation. And initially, we started off with kind of, you know, sort of a, I guess, a humble sort of picture of where we were going. You know, kind of like a traditional artist thing, where a bunch of artists get in an old beat up house and we like fix it up as best we can with our budget. And then it just grew. We got an investor and. Yeah, it's turned into, I would say, a 98-point renovation.
Yeah,
if you know what I mean, like all new windows, all new electrical, all new HVAC, all new
even a lot of the floor joists and ceiling joists are
And what's that called? Okay. And so I love the old homes, the old properties in town. In fact, we can talk about that a little bit more later. But as far as kind of replacing, updating, what's the goal? What was your goal originally? Was to keep as much of the original as possible? How much has been changed out? What is original that we're looking at right now?
Well, basically, the masonry is original.
The exterior walls.
Yeah. Bricks. Everything else has been a lot of the flooring, and I mean the floor joists.
Right.
And on the west side of the building had to be completely replaced. A lot of that stuff was built in, I guess, maybe the 20s or 30s. And so, for instance, instead of doing a single piece of wood for like a wall stud, they would sister three pieces of scrap together.
Oh, that's safe.
To make the, yeah. And the whole place was built that way on that side over there. So as soon as we started doing demo and pulling off the plaster, nothing was salvageable.
So it's like those home remodel shows where everything goes wrong.
Yeah. I think this was one of those cases.
In a way.
Yeah.
You know, because a lot of stuff did go wrong, but a lot of stuff that could go wrong didn't. You know, mm-hmm. we had a couple close calls here. Someone cut a gas line and I came in one morning and the whole house was full of natural gas.
That could have been the end of that.
Yeah, it could have been the end of this block, you know.
Or at least the end of this interview right now.
Oh, should I not talk about that?
No, that's terrifying.
Yeah,
it was horrifying. And so I ran out and turned off the gas meter real quick and put some fans on and I didn't realize how dangerous
smoke.
It was.
Yeah. Nobody light anything. Yeah.
One of the things that I think is really cool that is, you know, in line with what we were trying to do, thinking about this old versus new aesthetic, because we have this beautiful, for those of you who have not been to the Ario House or know what it is, I mean, it's a 10,000 square foot Victorian home built in the late 1800s. It's beautiful, right? And it's got this old character. And so we wanted to play tribute to that character, but we also wanted to bring a contemporary feel. So there's a lot of details in the house that kind of walk that line between contemporary and kind of Victorian aesthetic. So as an example, the windows and the fishbowl that we're in now, these are big solid pieces of glass, right? But before, these were individual panels. Each one of those, these was made out of three separate windows. Mm-hmm. They gave it that kind of original character, but this gives it a cleaner, slicker, kind of more modern feel.
I think it's a great balance.
There's a lot of instances where we try to do that. I think another thing that James has talked about since the beginning of this project that has resonated with me is that the interior of the house, you know, some of the millwork and all that, it holds the old world character, but everything's been pushed to white. It's a solid color of white, and it gives us this blank canvas to work from that isn't flat, right? It's got texture and it's got some interesting information going on with some of the detailing, but it's just this like nice blank canvas where the house doesn't impose itself on you and kind of just exists around you in this nice, comfortable way.
But even with the new wood that you brought in, some of the new trim and everything, new but still done in a very traditional way, right?
Yeah.
The mill and the woodworking is, who'd you work with?
So we used Ellis Planing Mill. For those of you who don't know, they're down off 25th Street in Wall. They're a more than 100-year-old local mill workshop, and they custom milled all of the work that's done in here. So if you look at our Instagram feed, you can see some of the photos of Cam McLeod, who has been a photographer for this project, documented some of it, and they were putting together these window skirts. These window skirts are five separate pieces that are all hand assembled, hand sanded, hand nailed. So I mean, it's pretty amazing, some of the detail. We tried to bring that level of craftsmanship that would have originally been in a home like this. We didn't want to just swing by Home Depot and pick some stuff up and throw it on.
Nothing against Home Depot.
But no, nothing. If you guys want to be a sponsor, we'll switch out some of the millwork.
Here's an interesting detail. So the house had some fairly ornate moldings in it, and they had just been beat up over the years. And so what we've done is we've taken that molding and take it to Ellis Milling, and they created custom tooling to replicate the original profile.
Wow.
So the fact that this is all new, but it's still the original profile, is kind of like a cool little tidbit, I think.
So now you can now call yourselves like home remodel artists.
I don't know that I would want to do this kind of thing again.
We're good.
I like yours. One and done. We're good. Yeah.
You know, it's fun, but not.
But you have space here to rent. So, so people can, I mean, not just hear about this on the podcast, but if this sounds of interest to you, there's space available.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so we'll take just a half a step back. So your intentions for the house originally, what it's kind of slowly developed into, and then the kind of the plans for the future.
So, like I said, we had our studio in the back and the house was for sale, and I was doing work back there, and I slowly started to realize that if I couldn't capture the house, it was going to sell and I was going to get back on the street, you know, back to looking for a studio, you know, 10 miles out west somewhere. So, I just tried to figure out a way to get control of the property so that we could, and, it sort of was Jake's concept with the, you know, the collaborative workspace thing. And it was kind of half of, from Startup Ogden, what, you know, the experiences I had there. And we just sort of rolled it together and tried to find people to buy into it. And yeah, so now we have this big building with all these beautiful office spaces and, right in the heart of the Nine Rails Creative District. And, we're about half full already with professional creative types.
Who are your original tenants? Who do you have in here right now?
Yeah. So, there's my business, which is Industrial Art and Design.
Do you guys have a website?
Yes, we do. IAD.design. Yeah. There's Jake McIntyre.
So I run Union Creative Agency, and we've got a small kind of studio in the back that I share with Cam McLeod. So UnionCreativeAgency.com, and then Cam McLeod is a local adventure photographer.
Yeah, we hate him. He's in Portland
right now. He's not great. He would probably be here with us, but he's on his en route to Portland for the world premiere of the Warren Miller, of which his work is featured, right? Yeah. So we've got...
But I hate him. I mean, I love hate him.
Exactly. No, we know.
Business consulting group with Bob Grueler is kind of the first office here outside of this space. And Bob does like marketing consulting, works with a lot of creative businesses, really tries to help us all have a better business brain. We should all call him.
Hey, I'm starting to work with him with Art in Action. And so he's a good person to know. He's very good at what he does.
And then also we have Galatea Digital in our basement suite, and they do app development and virtual reality programming and all kinds of photometric digital scanning, I think is how he describes
it. They're pretty cool. If you're ever here for an event, a lot of times his team will open up the space and put on display like virtual reality and some of the augmented reality stuff that they're doing. It's pretty crazy. It's like
we'll have to
the future is in the basement of the Argo House, I think.
I love that idea, but at some point we'll have to get together and record a podcast in a virtual space in our head. I think that'd be great.
I like that. That's kind of the list of current tenants that we have in the space. So it's a great mix of creative businesses that are doing varying level things. You know, really what we've thought about this space as, and part of the reason why we wanted to use the word house in the brand of this project was we want it to be really a home for the creative community. And, differently than maybe what something like Startup Ogden is, we didn't want to really be a space where, you know, you're just kind of testing or prototyping an idea, or you're really early, maybe not as much of a startup. We wanted to create a space where, you know, creative businesses that have outgrown somewhere like Startup Ogden could come, where maybe you don't want to go, like James was saying, rent a random space 10 miles out west that you can afford. We want to be able to have a space in the creative district that, you know, you can come and be part of a community and part of this house here.
I was trying to figure out why it felt like home, and you touched on some of that earlier on by the color choices and everything, because there are some older homes that were converted into office space here in Ogden, a lot of them like attorney spaces and things, and you walk into them and probably by design, they feel like a professional business space, you know, and they've lost that homey feel. But you walk in here and it does feel comfortable.
Yeah. Yeah. We absolutely wanted that warmth that when you walk into the space, you feel like you're walking into somebody's house in a way, right? We didn't want to lose that aesthetic. We want the community to feel welcome to come here. We want our tenants to feel like they're really part of a family when you kind of buy into this Argo House model. You're really becoming more than just a business in an office. We hope that together we are creating this kind of collaborative, almost like a family, right? Yeah. So we all collaborate. I think, you know, you could draw a map of the different collaborations that have existed so far, even before the space was open, between the different tenants, and it starts to create a pretty cool web. We've worked on some great things together. You know, and James and I worked on one of the first collaborations we did was with Chalet Larson, who was actually supported this project as an architect. But and if you don't know Chalet, an amazing local landscape architect with IO Design Collaborative, and the three of us partnered up on the Lester Park redesign project a couple of years ago now. And that was really like the first opportunity that James and I had to work together. And we ended up winning that project. And it just got us so excited to work on things together that when he walked me through this terrifying, empty, vacant building, you know, with like clear evidence.
Is a good sell.
I mean, it was pretty rough in here. Right.
And yeah.
Were the stairs usable?
The stairs didn't exist.
So that was
all covered back in, and there was a bedroom on top of where the stairwell is now. So that staircase actually was not there. It was built, part of it, some remnants were built into the wall, but basically that staircase, the main central staircase, was gone. It was pretty crazy when James walked me in here and was like, what could we do with this, right? And some good brainstorming sessions, and we had some great ideas, I think, and vision of what this space could hopefully become. It's pretty amazing now to be able to come here every day to work and run into people like James and Bob and Cam and Monty.
Inspiring is that too? Because you're all under the same roof now.
Yeah, it's literally unbelievable.
It's fun. It really is, because here's just a case, you know. I have this project and I'm trying to, you know, brainstorm solutions for this new space that we want to build a sculpture in. And, you know, you always want to try and push your personal boundaries. And it's so helpful to go to other people who have expertise in different fields and say, this is my challenge. What's your take on it? And, you know, I've had Monty go, well, I could, you know, if I were going to do it, I would do this and this. And I'm like, what is that? And he's like, oh, check it out. You know, and it's just so, it's educational. It's inspirational. As artists, a lot of people do this instinctively, you know, this collaborative kind of thing. But we leverage it as hard as possible. You know, it's one of those things where it works and do it.
Yeah,
we try to refer work to each other as much as possible.
The networking
too.
Piece.
I feel like, you know, in the music industry, the collaborations, they sort of own the collaborative space where all these musicians are, I have so-and-so on my album and so-and-so on my album. Mm-hmm. And I feel like other artists should definitely take that game plan and work and roll with it.
Yeah. A lot of times these, some of the big projects that, you know, ambitious people approach, you need a highly competent team to pull it off. It's beyond.
No question.
It's beyond the capabilities.
I think individually,
of one person.
You would be just completely overwhelmed to a point of maybe not even be able to get past that.
Yeah.
So that's another benefit of being here. You know, like I can put.
You can bite off more.
Yeah, you can.
For sure. Yeah, and we can put together really strong proposals, right?
Yep.
I mean,
sure.
We can leverage each other's portfolios because we are. I mean, while we aren't, you know, sort of organizationally connected to one another, we all work under this same fashion. So if I, you know, want to go for a public art commission, for instance, you know, my portfolio isn't going to be very competitive, but James's is. So I can go to James and say, hey, I want to submit for this RFP that I saw out. Will you partner with me? And can we leverage some of the work that you're doing? Or, you know, another example is I got a call from somebody who, as an example with public art, wanted to apply for a public art project. And it wasn't really up my alley, but I passed it along to James and together they collaborated on that and ended up getting awarded the project. And now it's one of the big things that they're working on. So it's just, I mean, it's kind of unbelievable to be able to be in the space to work in that way.
So if there's the artists who are listening to this podcast right now, they think, well, that's cool. I want to be involved. How does that happen? What steps should they take?
I think there's so many levels while you're kind of addressing this question, so many levels of involvement, right?
Right.
It doesn't
right.
have to be, you know, the top rung. There's so many ways to get involved in other areas. What do you guys think?
Yeah. So this Argo House project, you know, we have these private spaces that you can lease and have your own studio here, but we also have open space. Like we have a 1,000 square foot patio out here that's basically, from my perspective, public space.
And it really is kind of a one of a kind space here in town.
Yeah, it's very comfortable and interesting. And
it's big.
Yeah, it's big.
That's another thing that didn't exist before this project. We built that as part of the project.
I mean, I could see a music performance out there. I could see meetings out there. I could see life drawing out there. I could see someone doing a sculpture right there, you know, building it. And it's on 25th Street. I love the idea
of like an inflatable screen right there.
Yeah.
There's the outside. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's that. And then we're also doing meetings and other just interesting events here that people can just come to. We have quarterly, we're doing an art exhibition in our on the first floor here. And so people can come to see that at any time. You know, it's just come by and meet us. And
because during the day, doors are open to the public, essentially.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. Yeah, and there's usually at least a few of us around. And I think we, you know, generally work on pretty open door policy, right? If we're in our offices and we're open to chat, our doors are open and you're welcome to come and say hi and, you know, see the space.
Are not too intimidating. So I, you know, I'd say for sure take advantage of that opportunity.
Yeah, please do. And that's what we're here for.
So you couldn't be more excited, I'm sure. I mean, we're looking back like 3-4 years. It's kind of in the making, right? And so it's all kind of starting now, right? And so to be pioneers, like true pioneers in this particular area, A, congratulations and thank you for everything you've done. But B, now is when it really starts. And so now is when you can dig in, you can have a little bit more fun. But at the same time, it's a whole new set of, you know, discussions, issues.
Absolutely.
I mean, starting some momentum is a big deal, right? And you want to keep that going. So what are your kind of plans for the future? What's the next steps from the Argo House perspective?
So that's interesting you bring that up. I was just talking to Bob from Business Consulting Group earlier today about the idea that we're finished. The work's done. We built, you know, we did the renovation. And he's like, what do you mean? The work's just beginning. Now we have to build the brand and the culture and, you know, program activities and actually step up and contribute to the community like all of us feel like we need to. You know, I have this kind of, I guess it's a personal value, but I just feel like people should contribute to the extent of their capabilities. You know, if you can do something, offer it up, you know, be part of the community. And that's kind of what we're trying to do here. You know, we're designers, we're artists, we're this and that, but you know, we're trying to work and add value, you know, subjective value and objective value. You know, here's this space, you know, we're beautifying the neighborhood, we're helping people. So.
Yeah. And I would, you know, say, to build off of that, you know, we're still figuring some of these things out.
Heads been down so far
that like, let's get this project done and let's get this open. Just for perspective for people, we've, you know, we're maybe at the month mark, maybe not even quite to the month mark since we really officially opened up. So we're figuring out how do we use this space, but you know, having the Nine Rails Creative District Association, whatever that thing's called, having that meeting here a couple of weeks ago is a perfect example of the kind of stuff we'd like to see. And tonight, Jackson, who's our featured artist of the quarter, is going to be giving an artist talk about his work. And in a couple of weeks, we'll have some art in action events here. Maybe I guess we're about a month out on that. So we're trying to think about how do we activate this space. So we're exploring some of those things, but I think we want this to not function as just another building in Ogden that gets renovated, beautiful, and the doors are closed to the community. So we're exploring as many ways as we can to open up.
And a big part of what we're doing with this particular Nine Rails Arts podcast is we're exploring the district, right? Mm-hmm. And everything that kind of goes along with it. And the fact that you mentioned your work that you're going to be doing with Lester Park. I mean, there's so many moving parts and these projects, you know, are really long time, you know, in the works. When did you sort of propose that Lester Park idea? And what's the sort of time frame for even that following through? It just shows you when things pop up, you know, this is like the behind the curtains. It takes a little time to get to those points, right?
Yeah, I mean, that was probably 2015 when we were working on that project, if I remember right.
I like the idea of things moving a little quicker than that, but that's the reality sometimes.
I mean, that's the reality. And, you know, I don't know exactly where that project sits, to be honest, with city. I mean, I think it's fundraising at the moment and trying to figure out where does the money come from.
But though, like, this is something that's going to happen.
I mean, you know, it's interesting. For those of you who don't know, the work that I do, a lot of my work is related in community development. I don't even have a clue what I do.
All I can assume is that whenever something creative happens, Jake's involved somewhere at some level.
Right. But, you know, I was working kind of through undergrad as a studio artist doing sculpture, and graduate school, I shifted a little bit and I started thinking about kind of community development and the way that communities change over time. And that research and that work led me back to Ogden. But one of the things that's still like so shocking to me when you talk about time is a great mentor of mine told me that with the work that I was interested in doing, and really the work kind of we're all doing with big picture creative work, is the work we're doing won't be done until long after we're gone. And I've kind of made that cognitive shift where I think of everything very, very long term, right? So yes, the Argo House took us a couple of years. Yes, it's open now, but really the work of the Argo House and the work of the Nine Rails Creative District and everything, like, we're not building it just for us. We're building it for future generations. And so that's what I really admire about this, the way that James and the team took on the Argo House, is like, this house is built to last another couple hundred years. Right. This wasn't a renovation that we're not flipping this place.
Well,
right. And that's I think that's a mentality that's been lost a little bit in our society. And so that's, you know, as I work on varying projects around the district, I'm thinking of it in that longer term, right? Yes, we want to do things that are exciting for us now, but, you know, shouldn't we really be building communities for future generations and making Ogden this great place to be, not just for us now, but for generations to come? So it's kind of how I think.
And you know what? I love this idea that we are here now, us, you know, this group of people, and the Nine Rails is starting, and it's our opportunity to express ourselves and take this ball and run with it. You know?
Yes, sir.
I mean, like, we're the people who are here, and it's time to do it. And we're trying to make things happen to the extent that we can.
I feel like hands in.
Captain Planet.
Yeah, that was great.
Well, thank you so much for taking some time. I do appreciate that. This will not be the last time that we're out here in the fishbowl. You know, I appreciate you having us over.
Yeah, use it whenever.
The view is very nice. Yeah. Except for next time, we're going to bring a sixer, though. So that'll happen next time. So.
But the coffee is actually really good.
No, it was perfect for today. The weather's kind of a coffee weather day, so it's kind of nice. Yeah. Anything else before we kind of split off?
No, I guess I would add lastly that we didn't really talk about the fact that we have spaces for lease. You guys kind of pointed us in that direction. So the website for the Argo House is theargohouse.co, so like.com, but without the M. And you can reach out to us that way. Annette Hylison is kind of the Argo House ambassador, so she handles a lot of the community relations details and leasing, but we have spaces available and ranging from 450, 800, 1,000, and 2,000. And then we also have kind of a community membership level where if you want to be here to use some of the common space, but you don't necessarily need a set office, we can make that available too. So reach out to us, let us know, you know, how you want to get involved. And this is really meant to be a space for the community.
James, cool. Any last words?
Thanks for coming out here.
Well, I appreciate you saying that.
We're trying to make this happen, and you're helping us. We appreciate that.
Yeah. Well, you're very welcome. Thank you. Absolutely.
Yeah. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks.
All right. So, setting up for the van sessions in October. The Ogden Symphony Ballet Association were able to book Ballet X here in town, and we were lucky that they wanted to, you know, chat with us and have an interview. So they came down to a van, a strange van, at the Monarch Building.
I think we're starting to get a little bit of a reputation, so it's not so creepy. It's not so strange. In fact, people actually want to get into the van now. But what worked out great was I think that they were staying at the Bigelow Hotel, which is like half a block down from where we were set up.
Yeah.
And so they came and joined us pre-van sessions. So the timing was absolutely perfect.
Yeah.
But there was no dancing on their side, but we definitely used the mobile tan van studios for this interview.
It's hard to dance in a van, although next time we get a ballet dancer in the van, we have to see if they can. We'll put the challenge out there.
There's a little bit of room there.
Yeah. And we did get we introduced you to a new co-host on the Nine Rails Arts podcast, my daughter, who had a couple of questions for the dancers. And
she stepped up the game with those questions. They were very good.
Props to her. They came from a dancer's perspective. I wouldn't have thought about those questions. So this is our interview with Ballet X Associate Artistic Director Tara Keating, along with dancer Richard Villaverde.
Podcast champions, have you been on the podcast much before?
No, actually. Our first time. I think this is our first podcast.
Yeah.
Going to go ahead and break you in a van.
Yeah.
A sketchy van. In the heart of the Nine Rails Arts District in Ogden, Utah. So, we are in a van down by the Monarch here in the core of the new Nine Rails Arts District. And it's right
that
before
the new Monarch building.
Monarch, what'd I say?
I don't know.
Monarch building. we have in the van with us, well, Ballet X is in town. They're performing on Saturday up at the Browning Building, Saturday, October 6th. We have Tara Keating, Associate Artistic Director, and Richard Villaverde, dancer.
Yep.
Yeah, see, I had to get the little. I didn't quite get the role in, though. Yeah, so Tara Keating, let's start with you. 2005, Ballet X began. What was the genesis that was behind it to help start Ballet X?
So myself and Christine Cox and Matthew Neenan, those two are the founders of Ballet X. We were all dancers at the Pennsylvania Ballet and had been there for 10 years, them for 15 years. Mm-hmm. And we're looking to do something a little bit different. We had been spending our summers creating Ballet X and doing summer performances, but after doing Swan Lake and Sleeping Beauty for third and fifth times, we were just ready to kind of branch out mm-hmm. and create world premiere ballets, which is what we do at Ballet X. So that's kind of how it all started.
Is that the X part?
That's the X part.
The X, a lot of people ask that, has a lot of different meanings. Initially, they liked the kind of the length of the lines because it had a mm-hmm. feeling of going on forever. But the X could mean exploring, Xfinity. And we kind of leave that up to the audience to decide what the X is. So it doesn't have a definitive meaning.
It's not the rating.
It is not the rating. We've been asked that. There are not three X's. Only one.
Just one.
Yeah.
Sometimes. So, you're classically trained, but then you reach outside of that to, so tell me how you break out of the mold of the classical ballet.
Yeah. I mean, our dancers train in ballet every day, mm-hmm. and most of them have a pretty strong ballet background, and that's really the mission of Ballet X, is to expand the vocabulary of classical dance. So mm-hmm. we bring in choreographers from all over the world who are, you know, mostly contemporary choreographers, but their base and their root is classical ballet. And we love to see how that grows and how it blends together. And we've created some really amazing works.
Yeah.
Yeah, so as a dancer, how much do you have say in the choreography, I guess?
I think we get the opportunity to work with so many different people that it's always a little different and depends on the choreographer, and kind of sometimes it's collaborative and we can work mm-hmm. with them and they kind of allow us to give our own artistic input. And then sometimes it's kind of they know what they want and it's very specific to their work and, you know, the way that they like their pieces to look, or they might have a specific idea or certain just a certain idea that they really want us to portray. So then it's a little bit more strict and we don't have as much freedom. But I think everyone that comes in gives us artistic freedom and wants to collaborate with us, which is the best part, because then you feel like as a dancer, you're growing artistically.
Yeah.
And you're also like being challenged by movement that you've never done before. So
speaking of growing artistically, so catch us up on sort of your trajectory from, we don't have to start from birth, but probably pretty early on to... the van.
Okay, perfect. So I was a late bloomer. I started dancing when I was 13.
That's crazy.
That is late bloomer. Yeah. Huh?
I actually think that's better because I feel like a lot of my friends in high school were already burning out. They've been dancing since they were three or four, and like they were just like, oh, I don't want to do it. But I think starting at 13, I really got serious. Around 15 or 16, I got scholarships to go to many different summer programs and stuff like that. And that's when I was like, okay, I think I want to buckle down with this. And then luckily, I got a full scholarship to go to the University of the Arts in Philadelphia, which is where I met Christine and Tara. And Christine, the director of the company, was my teacher for many years. And then I came back from studying abroad, and she offered me the position right on my senior year. So I got to finish my last year of college and start my first year of professional work. And this is
Richard was living the life. He was getting his degree his last semester and was dancing with Ballet Act. So it was really like what all the students at that school are, you know, striving
to do. To get a job out of school. And luckily, like my senior year, I just got like it was like
but
handed to
that
me.
Wasn't
so
luck. I mean, you busted your ass really hard for that. I busted
my butt for sure. Yeah. But I mean, I think it was just like, I think it's always just like a timing thing, like right place.
And
I was at the right moment at the right time. Yeah. And it just kind of like, I wanted it so bad. I was so hungry that like, I was so grateful that that opportunity just fell in my lap. So,
and you can dance.
And I can dance.
Yeah.
Thank God.
You can dance really well.
So with artistic expression, and where is it growing? How's it growing in 2018? Like how are you taking that next step as a dancer in 2018 in ballet?
I think it's important to respect the tradition of classical dance and of any classical form, of any traditional form of dance, and then with that respect try and bend the what it can do, stretch the possibilities, and kind of, I think artistically that's up to you. And I think we have so much freedom and working with so many different people that like I can do the same step and two different minds can manipulate that step in two completely different directions. And then sometimes I get input that I can manipulate that same step in my own way. So I think, honestly, it's just collaboration and where your mind is and trying to push your limits and push the people around you. I think also I'm always pushed by the dancers. We have such an amazing group of dancers right now.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I can't help but look and be like, oh, I gotta like do a little more. Like, look at him. He's like amazing. You know, so I think your peers also have a big, big input in your artistic choices.
So it's competitive, sort of?
Yeah,
I think competitive, but you push each
other.
Friendly
way. It is. Yeah. I think it's always competitive, but I think it should always be friendly, and I think it should always be understanding. You know, like we all love the work and we all love what we're doing, but we all also want to be the best that we can be and push ourselves. I want someone to push me to my limits, and maybe I can find something in my dancing that I never thought I had until you push me there. You know, so
yeah.
Brandon, we try to do that to each other.
I push him in his dancing; he pushes me in mine.
We have to, but because of that, we respect classical podcasting. So yeah, we have the same.
That's true.
But we do try to kind of push that. It's frighteningly similar story.
I kind of like look at it like, you know how when you like you're sleeping and like someone wakes up before you and you're like, oh, what are they doing? Like, are they up? Like, and then you get up way earlier than you should have. It's kind of like that. It's like if someone is just challenging you like just a little bit, you're gonna be like, oh, well, like I'm gonna go over there with you and see what you're doing. So I think it's really, really important. I think your environment and like who you're around every day.
And these dancers, they really can do it all. I mean, it's what's so incredible about them.
Meaning
they do classical ballet, they can do hip hop, they can do jazz, with these choreographers that we bring
in. They can usher you to your seats if you need to.
They can really mold their bodies and adapt to these different works that they're doing.
And is that what you ask of all your dancers?
It is. Yeah. And I think the other great thing is that we have 10 dancers, 5 men and 5 women, so our audiences really get to know each individual.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're about diversity and bringing out the personalities of each dancer. And we feel really proud about the group that we've gathered together.
At what point did you know that you wanted to be a professional dancer? That this is what you want to do for the rest of your life. Do you remember that?
I think I do. Yeah, I was like 10 years old and my mom took me to see the New York City Ballet in Saratoga Springs. They have a summer season up there and they did Coppelia. And I saw this woman, her name is Stephanie Salon. She was a principal dancer with New York City Ballet and I idolized her. And after the show, I was like, Mom, I really want to do that. I mean, I had been taking ballet since I was three, but at 10, I know it sounds like, kind of crazy, but I was
so
like...
So what choices did you make at that point, at 10, to say, okay, where do we get serious?
Well, up until that point, I had been taking tap and jazz and acrobats, mm-hmm. and I was going to a school that had all of that, and then I was going to a school that just... specialized in ballet, and my ballet teacher was like, you've got to stop taking tap, Tara. I mean, I was doing competitions, and she really wanted me to just focus on the ballet. She was like, you know, you have what it takes, and you know, I'd been telling her, like, this is what I want to do. So when I was about 12, I stopped tapping, which made me sad because I love to tap, but at 12 I was like, okay, and my mom was like, okay, this is the route that you're gonna go, you know, if I wanted to, and I did.
Yeah. Richard, do you remember?
Yeah, I had done my first summer intensive at American Ballet Theater, and at school, I was kind of just like, I was the only guy in my class in my performing arts high school. So I kind of never really looked at the other girls, but I never really had any other guys to really, like, I guess, push me in class, you know, and stuff. And when I went to ABT, I saw all those men and like just how they carried themselves. And I saw that I wasn't really, I knew that I hadn't been applying myself correctly, and I was still kind of keeping up. So I was like, I think if I like really apply myself, I can do this.
Yeah.
And then I was like, okay, I have to do this. Yeah.
I don't know if this is good or bad, but how I know dance today is from my daughter who's 8 and from So You Think You Can Dance on TV. which the men, they keep getting more, you know, more men that are, and they're just unbelievable dancers. So are more men dancing now than there were maybe a few years ago?
Of course, more than ever. Yeah. I think like that, I think all kinds of stereotypes and all kinds of stigmatisms are really breaking now in 2018. You know, there is no stereotypes really in dance anymore. A lot of men dance. And
those shows have been helpful in exposing it to people who don't know about it necessarily. Yeah,
but
well, I have my daughter here, Isla. She's 8-year-old, excels in Celtic beat dancing, but does do a little ballet on the side. Do you have a question you want to ask, Isla?
Let's hear it.
Oh, you didn't have one in mind? You think about that and we'll come back to you. But you got like 1 minute.
Okay.
Okay. So there's a lot of... probably parents who might be listening who have kids in dance. So as professionals, what's the best advice to parents who have kids in dance that maybe are serious about it?
I actually work with students a lot. I teach a lot back at my home studio, and I find it really, my mom was never super, super involved in my dancing, but I think I really love that because it made it feel like it was just mine. And I think if I have any advice for parents, just, you know, just be honest and open with your kids and let them do whatever they wish to do. You know, I think sometimes parents really want kids to dance or, you know, want something for them that maybe that kid maybe not doesn't want, but let them explore all kinds of options, you know, like... I love that my parents let me explore sports, and then I tried swimming, and then I tried dancing, and then I tried basketball and baseball. So I kind of think it's like you never know what someone's going to be good at until like you have them just try different things. So I think just listen to your kids. They're smarter than we think.
And they're always listening.
They're always listening.
Yeah,
so,
they are.
we have Richard and Tara from Ballet X here at the Van. They're performing at the Browning Center, or did perform by the time you hear this. So thank you for coming into town.
You were fantastic, by the way.
So good. The crowd went wild.
Other than that one thing, like, oh my gosh, that one thing.
You saw that.
That was horrible.
But you tour all over the U.S. or all over the world? How does that go?
All over the U.S. Soon to be all over the world.
That's so exciting. Awesome.
It's exciting.
We just signed with a big agent, so we're hoping to explore.
Very cool.
That sounds fantastic.
Yeah.
First time in Utah?
For me, yes. You?
Second time in Utah. Yeah. I was in Salt Lake before.
What do you think? You had a chance to peek around our little mountain town.
I love this town. It's so artsy beautiful. And cute. And there's so many like little historical like things in this town. You can tell there's a lot of history here, like a lot of old history. I heard like 7 stories, like
it's all true
already.
My hotel is haunted.
You're staying next door,
Bigelow.
Right?
Yeah, and I heard like some story about like the train station, how they would like transport liquor to like the Bigelow or something from down there. I don't know.
It's all true.
All kinds of stories.
It was quite the notorious town. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Do you have a question?
Okay,
all right. 2 questions.
You gotta get close though.
How long have you guys been dancing?
I've been dancing now for, oh my God, 13 years? 13 years. Yeah,
13
so
years.
So I'm not dancing professionally anymore, but I danced from when I was 3 to 39. So, like, can you do the math? A long 36. Time.
That's a lot. Yeah.
36 years.
Yep. Okay, question number two.
Question number two. How many dances do you know?
That is a great question. And I'll tell you that these Ballet X dancers know a lot of dances. We have a really big repertory that we keep, so they have a lot of steps in their brain. Richard can talk more about
it. Yeah, we learn a lot of dances. We know a lot. And I feel like if I learn something for the first time really well, it'll just stay with me forever. At least I like to think that. but yeah, I think I have like a good 10, 11, 12 pieces in my head right now.
All at once.
Yeah, once. I mean, we can sometimes be doing 10 different pieces, you know, not in one show, but mm-hmm. like but just within like a 2 month span.
Yeah.
How long does it take to learn one dance? Months, weeks?
It depends, honestly, on the choreographer and mm-hmm. who we're working with. Honestly, it's harder for me to learn work that's already been set and that I have to learn. That's really hard for me for some reason. But when it's created on my body and I have the time to explore it a little more, then it feels more personal, like it comes from me. But learning steps from someone else and then transferring them onto me and making them mine is a little harder.
You still dance like at home, alone, in front of a mirror?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Like every day.
Me too.
In the shower.
Yeah, me too.
Shower dance.
Yeah, shower dance. Yeah. I love it.
Well, that's brilliant. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you guys. Thanks for having us. Super fun.
Yeah, thank you for stepping into the van last minute, kind of. So thank you, Andrew. Again, Tara Keating and Richard Villaverde.
Yes.
Dancers and artistic director with Ballet X. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
You guys were awesome. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Put a bow on it. That's a wrap for episode 6 of the Nine Rails Arts Podcast, produced by the Banyan Collective. Arts and adventure podcasting since 2010. You can follow the Nine Rails Arts Podcast on Facebook and also on Instagram at the number 9 for Nine Rails. Search the Banyan Collective on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. You can also search the Nine Rails Arts Podcast on iTunes and Spotify. This week, we'll leave you with a little something out of our van session archives from Carrie Myers. Carrie recently teamed up with Nine Rails Arts Podcast house band The Proper Way on their new album, Ain't No Good Thing Ever Dies, available on October 16th. Join us November 2nd for the next Van Sessions live at the Monarch, where The Proper Way, along with Ryan Hawthorne and Carrie Myers, will debut songs off the new album. So, in anticipation, this is Carrie Myers way back on season 2 of Van Sessions with...
This song is it's called Oregon.
Still.
Oh, the time is running out, my lungs turn into sand as I breathe in. I'm sinking faster than I swim. The bones beneath my breast are collapsing. And I can always follow through, but I'll fall through my walls to be with you. Taking all your consequences too. But I can't find the time to run to you. Oregon is calling me. I think I was born for running. Leave you here without me. Don't be sad, I love you, darling. Oregon is calling me. I think I was born for running. Past, past, past my past. When I'm still, my heart is thumping. No sign of an exit wound. I guess Utah is coming with me. I'll break my own heart to mend it with the North Pacific trees. I'm cold, condescending, think they'd outfit perfectly. When you are bold with condensation, pouring out your evergreens. Oregon is calling me. I think I was born for running. Leave you without me. Don't be sad, I love you, darling. Oregon. Oregon is calling me. I think I was born for running past, past this, I'm past, I'm past this. Oregon is calling me. I think I was born for running. Leave you without me. Don't be sad, I love you, darling. Oregon is calling me. I think I was born for this. And I'll run, I'll run, I'll run until I'm in Oregon.
Carrie Myers, everyone.